Ladies and gentlemen, welcome and thank you very much for attending. I'm Senator Mary Jo Fisher and I'm very pleased to have been asked by our wonderful Parliamentary Library to chair today's vital session on Matters NBN. Of course, you all know the National Broadband Network. And for those of you who might be a bit new like me, the Vital Issues seminars organised by our Parliamentary Library have been running since about 1986 to give ventilation to vital issues and have us hear from notable speakers, eminent and expert in the particular field, as we will today. And welcome to Paul Fletcher and Henry Ergus. So this is the place of politics, of course, but hopefully in the session today we'll be largely devoid of politics. And in terms of process, what I'm going to propose is that we hear firstly from Mr. Fletcher for about 20 minutes and then Mr. Regis for about 20 minutes. But Mr. Regis has said, I'm not sure that's long enough, so he's busy pruning whilst we wait. And then there'll be an opportunity for questions so that we wrap up by 1:30. So without any further ado, I'm going to introduce our first speaker, Mr. Fletcher, who's of course well known no doubt to many of you through his authorship of articles and being quoted in notable newspapers like The Australian and, I guess, more particularly for his book Wired Brown Land. Paul currently runs a consultancy called Fletcher Group Advising and has a background in matters regulatory and strategic advising in particularly in telecommunications. He spent about 8 years as an advisor to then Minister for Telecommunications Richard Alston, and about 8 years with Optus, should I say, and prior to that about 4 years with former Minister Richard Alston. Paul is also very well studied. You mightn't remember this, but the particularly interesting thing, and both our experts today have a particularly interesting thing, but for Paul, not only has he got first class honours in law and economics, but he's also been to Columbia Uni in New York as a Fulbright scholar. So thank you, Paul. We look very much to hearing from you.
Thank you very much, Mary Jo, for that generous introduction. And it's a great pleasure to be speaking at this seminar. Telecommunications regulation can, of course, be a rather dry and esoteric subject, but over the past few years it has generated a remarkable amount of attention, partly, of course, due to the fleeting visit to our shores of such colourful characters as Sasha Hero and Phil Burgess. And in my book I describe Burgess as a rotund, bellicose figure with a florid turn of phrase and a knack for generating media coverage. But partly also broadband infrastructure has become quite an important indicator of international competitiveness and in turn therefore a subject, as we know, of some political controversy. Sufficiently fascinating to me that I wrote a book about it, and I discovered that Henry had also written a book as I was about to finish mine. Henry, of course, is a very eminent figure in Australian telecommunications policy. I first met him when I began working for Richard Alston, and much of what I know about telecommunications economics and regulation I learned from Henry, although he is no doubt disappointed that I have rather got off the reservation since those days. Look, for telecommunications pointy heads, and for the community more generally, the announcement that the government made on the 7th of April was very significant for three reasons. Firstly, it committed the government to a $43 billion project when it had previously said in its policy it would spend $4.7 billion. Secondly, you had an announcement that the government was going to start up in competition with the existing private sector businesses in the space. And thirdly, there was a foreshadowing of some very significant regulatory measures directed particularly at Telstra. And I think several important questions flow from that. How is it that the objectives of the judiciary system have been seen to have failed to an extent that such measures are considered to be necessary. How important has the growth of broadband been in the overall picture? And in particular, the fact that in Australia, as elsewhere around the world, we are facing a transition to a new broadband network architecture with much more optical fibre in the network and therefore much higher speeds being delivered to end users. And in every country, that is raising some tricky questions for public policy. And thirdly, then, what is the way forward? In other words, what are the key priorities for turning this very significant announcement into reality? So let me turn first to the question of whether the current system has met its objective. It's generally agreed that competition is a very good thing and that in telecommunications policy, what has been the objective in a bipartisan sense since the early 90s has been to drive competition and in turn deliver better services, lower prices, more innovation. In the mobile sector, that has been a very successful policy. We've seen a relentless rise in take-up. We've seen mobile penetration now exceeding 100%. Continuing innovation in services, with GSM coming along, with third generation mobile, all kinds of value-added services, content and so on. And that in turn has been because we've had a genuinely competitive market structure. Until recently, four separate operators, each with their own network, and now three, and the largest player, Telstra, having only just over 40% in market share. Now the contrast to fixed line is quite instructive because Telstra retains a share of over 70% in most services. And in my book I argue that the root cause for this was a fundamental mistake made in the early 90s when Kim Beazley, Minister for Transport and Communications at the time, chose to put together Telecom and OTC to create a monster, Telstra, rather than the alternative which would have been to use the two as the nucleus for two competitors. And so you had a set of competitive dynamics established from the beginning which made it extremely challenging for new entrants. Now, in recognition of that challenge, part of the policy at the time was to establish the so-called access regime under which Optus, as the sanctioned competitor at the time, could build out some of its own network and could then rent access to Telstra's network to be able to deliver an end-to-end service, with the classic example being delivering a long-distance service from Sydney to Melbourne. Optus built out quickly the long-distance fibre, the inter-office fibre between the capitals, but then it used the Telstra access network to be able to complete the calls. And had the access regime not been in place to allow this, then you would have seen competition get off to a much slower start. And Australia's not alone in having an access regime where the incumbent is required to allow its competitors to rent access to the network. The same, those core principles continued in 97 when Optus was joined by a whole bunch of other competitors. The access regime, nevertheless, has always been contentious. Telstra has always thoroughly disliked it because of a view, I'd suggest, that if it was not subject to an access regime, it could make more money. And to remind you of one of the colourful observations from Phil Burgess, he said, if McDonald's has to go to a regulator before it goes into business and declare what it's going to do on its ovens, and Hungry Jack's comes across the street and says, I want to buy those fish sandwiches, by the way, at a discounted price, and by the way, I get the first batch, and I'm going to sell a lot of them, and if you want more, you've got to build another oven, and by the way, you build the oven at your own expense, and by the way, the cost of the air conditioning, the gas, the electricity, the lights, those don't go into the price. So look, he's a colourful character and we miss him, and he did manage to communicate some points effectively, and the point he was making was Telstra thoroughly disliked the access regime. Let me detour for a second to highlight a key difference between Henry Rivas and myself. Henry, I think it's fair to say, is an articulate advocate of one strand of thinking. If I'm not mischaracterising him, I think Henry's view is that if you want competition, you will only get that through new players coming in to invest and build network. And frankly, if you give new players a free ride on Telstra's network, then that is what they will take, and you will never see them actually investing and taking a risk. And in response to that, I'd say a couple of things. Firstly, it's certainly not a free ride. In many cases, Telstra makes as much money reselling services as it does through selling them under its own brand. But putting that to one side, I think you have to concede that in the first place world it would be great if we had multiple competing fixed access networks just as we had multiple competing mobile networks. The problem is that Australia is simply too large and thinly populated to support more than one fixed-line telecommunications network, particularly given the natural monopoly characteristics of the industry. That is to say, whoever starts first has the biggest scale, therefore can achieve the lowest cost per customer, and therefore has a sustainable, enduring advantage over anybody else who comes in. And we saw that play through when Optus came into the market in the mid-90s to build a competing HFC network in competition with the Telstra access network and could never match the Telstra economics. And as a consequence, that network has never been a financial success. Anybody looking at coming in as a new entrant into the fixed line market today will be informed by that experience and will be very reluctant to invest. So therefore, if you believe, as I do, that we're in a second best world, where a new commercially funded fixed line network is very unlikely, then what is the best way to stimulate competition? And certainly that was the intention behind the access regime, to encourage competition based upon using Telstra's network, paying for it, in combination with components of network built by the new entrants. It is clear, though, that whether there is a new broadband network on the agenda or not, that 12 years into the access regime, we can identify some significant flaws in the way it operates on a day-to-day basis. And I say this in full acknowledgement of the fact that I was an advisor to Minister Ralston when the regime was devised and introduced. But, you know, it's a characteristic of humanity that we have the capacity to learn from experience, and the experience is there are some problems with the access regime. And the fundamental problem arises because of Telstra's vertical integration. It will always treat its wholesale customers as second-class citizens compared to its own retail business. And bear in mind that for about 80% of Australian premises, the Telstra connection is the only one that's there. So in effect, they have a monopoly on the access network. And so therefore, their preference is going to be to deliver services at retail. They do sell at wholesale, but largely because they are compelled to. Sol Trujillo, for example, refused to even meet with the chief executive of his largest competitor, his largest customer, Optus. And certainly, in my years, being responsible for the Optus spend each year with Telstra, it was surprising how often they were reluctant to be selling services. So, another consequence of vertical integration, which again undermines retail competition, is that Telstra has the means and motive to use its vertical integration in a range of ways. It can engage in a retail wholesale price squeeze in which it drops retail prices while leaving wholesale prices the same. And it did that with consumer DSL in 2004. Sometimes, for a bit of variety, it does the price squeeze the other way around. So it increases the wholesale price while leaving the retail price the same way. It did that with line retail prices in December 2005. So all of this is to say, we have a regime that's designed to encourage competition, but you have a fundamental problem because of Telstra's vertical integration. And the arrival of consumer DSL in Australia is a particular example of how that's played out. Because essentially you saw Telstra, for its own very good commercial reasons, working to suppress the arrival and the take-up of DSL, the basic technology for the delivery of consumer broadband. It was only in 2004 when Optus entered the market offering a competing DSL service that Telstra chose to drop its prices significantly, and in turn we saw a significant increase in take-up at that point. So you really had an inflection point there. So the point I'm making is simply this. Telstra was able to use its dominance of the market to carry out a strategy which commercially made sense to it, namely to slow the arrival of DSL because it wanted to extract the maximum profit out of the existing service, which was dial-up internet. That was not in the national interest, I would argue, and indeed, with broadband being such a hot policy issue, one of the relevant points is, for much of the early part of this decade, Australia lagged behind other countries in terms of penetration. One of the key drivers of that was Telstra's pricing policies, which were rational from its self-interested point of view, but which did not, I argue, serve the national interest. In that context, it is, I think, ironic that Telstra's former head of corporate affairs, Phil Burgess, went around Australia complaining about Australia's low broadband penetration, when, in my view, this was largely due to Telstra's own pricing policies. And as I say in the book, I think that is akin to Robert Mugabe complaining about Zimbabwe's high inflation. Not only did, so let me now turn then to the role of broadband, conscious as I am that time is running out. How important has the growth of broadband been in the sort of policy challenges that we now face and which have, as I said, led the government to the announcement of a couple of months ago? I think there are three clear conclusions we can draw about the broadband market today. These are numbers based mid-2009, but I think the conclusions remain valid. Firstly, it's a very large market. So it's grown very rapidly. There's now over 6 million broadband services. Secondly, that remains strikingly dominated by Telstra. And that is, I think, very significant because this is a product which did not even exist when Telstra was deregulated or open to competition, I should say, in the early 90s. So it's been able to leverage its dominance in one market into another. But thirdly, there is one encouraging area of competition, which is unbundling, which, as we know, is the regulatory ruling under which Telstra's competitors are able to rent the copper wires connecting the exchanges to homes. In turn, they can put their own electronic equipment into the exchanges and deliver their own end-to-end broadband services. And in my view, by 2008 and more so today, unbundling was a bright spot in a landscape which otherwise struggled under the dull conformist yoke of the incumbent. This was a trial for flourish. But the key point was you had some choice being delivered into the market on dimensions like the speed that was available. So while Telstra sought to cap speeds at lower levels, new entrants came in differentiating with ADSL 2+. You had choice about pricing. You even had choice about product design features, such as whether, when a consumer took the service, the broadband service, they were also required to take a voice telephony line rental service. In other words, that is what policymakers in the early 90s would have hoped to see. Competition working to deliver choice to consumers who could take the Telstra service, or they could go to Optus, or iiNet, or Primus. They could go to iiNet and get a naked DSL service, for example, and not take the voice telephony as well. So unbundling was a bright spot, but then a new development was, as I have said in Australia as in other countries, the arrival of a new broadband architecture. This is a slide I've been using for about 4 years, so it focuses on fibre to the node. But the key point, I think, is an obvious one. In the old world, you had copper from the exchange to the home. In the fibre to the node world, you're talking about fibre to the node, halfway between the exchange and the home, and then copper. And in the new world, it's now comprised of fibre to the premises, so fibre all the way. An important point is it makes unbundling impossible, and some have been uncharitable enough to suggest, and I have been amongst those, that was a reason why Telstra jumped on the fibre bandwagon, because it had the incidental benefit of chilling competition in the short term. Undoubtedly, though, there are good reasons for having a fibre network, and operators are introducing them on commercial grounds around the world. Clearly higher speeds for end users, also operational efficiencies and so on. But my argument is, for today's purposes, that the arrival of these kinds of new networks has been an important catalyst for the kind of regulatory changes that the Rudd government is now contemplating, because of the way that Telstra in particular sought to use the arrival of these new networks to protect itself against competition through the kind of deals it was offering in 2005, in which it would build a new broadband network if the access regime were removed, so that it could in effect resume a fixed line monopoly. In the interest of time, I won't go through the sequence of events. It's documented in my book, if you're that interested. But in my view, that has been a significant contributor to the, the broader intention of government to look at substantial regulatory change. So in the interest of time, let me move then to the last area that I wanted to cover quickly, which is what are the priority issues that need to be addressed to give effect to some of the objectives that have been articulated by the government and that appear to be consistent with some of the objectives going back to the early 90s. And in my view, one thing that is important, perhaps the most important thing, is to get a market structure that will foster genuine competition, and I believe the way to do that is through the structural separation of Telstra. Because if you have a network owned by a company that sells only wholesale services, then its management team will be highly motivated to do just that, sell those services, and in turn that will spark vigorous competition at the retail level. So I'm conscious that I'm just about out of time, so I'll close on this point. What I have argued for in my book is what I've described as perhaps somewhat pretentiously a grand settlement in Australian telecommunications regulation. Let's get the fundamental market structure right, and then let's sweep away some of the superstructure of unnecessary regulation which has been built up over the years, which in my view has been put there in many ways to compensate for the fundamental problems with the market structure. It's not dissimilar to the approach taken in the UK, where you had effectively an agreement reached between Ofcom and British Telecom, some of the same notions of a fundamental settlement. So if I close there in the interest of time, simply by saying that this is undoubtedly a very exciting time for the telecommunications sector. The potential for Australia, I believe, is very exciting, but the most important priority in my view is to get the market structure right so that you have competition working vigorously. If you get the competition right, I think the right technology will follow.
Now, you reckon that Henry might have been using the time to prune his presentation, but I reckon, given that Paul was a former student of Henry's on his own testimony, albeit de facto, that Henry was probably spending the time marking Paul. Henry Lewis will be well known to many of you as the author of Wrong Number, Resolving Australia's Communications. He's an economist. He's currently chairman of Concept Economics. He has expertise in telecommunications, competition policy, and regulated economics. He's a professor at Monash University, and he's a lay member of the New Zealand High Court. So, to tell us about perhaps laying some cables for Australia's telecommunications, Henry Ugas. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That is a very flattering introduction. I hope you can hear me. Yes, thank you. I should say before I get into the substance of my presentation that everything I will say here today reflects my own views, and obviously not necessarily the views of any of Concept's clients. So let me make that clear by way of preface. I have a presentation which I've, in a very old-fashioned way, written out. I always find that when I don't, I get terribly confused, more a sign of age than anything else. But I think it would be better if any of you were interested in it, I'd be happy to make it available to you. And instead of working through that, maybe to quickly cover off some of the points that that Paul raised. And I think Paul did a very good job of setting out some of the background and setting out some of the key issues that need to be faced.
How many out of 10, Henry? Come on.
I need more time to compare him to others before I come to it.
Always.
Nowadays you're required to look at bell-shaped curves and all that sort of thing. So that makes life much more difficult. But nonetheless, he did a good job, and I'm grateful to Paul for that. I think there's really a few fairly basic issues here. And one issue is what you think really has been at work in the period up to now in terms of our telecommunications history and the outcomes that it's generated, what you might regard as the diagnosis of the situation. Secondly, what prescriptions you draw from that. And then third, where you think you ought to go in terms particularly of the challenges and issues that are raised by the government's announcement of a new broadband network. And what I would propose to do is say a few words about each of those. Let me start with the first, which is how, in summary terms, do we assess what's happened over the period, really from the start of telecommunications liberalisation, which was in 1989-1990 in Australia, till the present. And obviously, there are many factors at work over that period, and people will differ in the emphasis they place on each of those factors. But what it seems to me is particularly striking is this, is that whatever you may think about the period that went really from 1989 or 1991 to 1997, when we moved into the new telecommunications regime, over that period, from 1991 to 1997, rightly or wrongly, a number of networks were rolled out, and so both Telstra and Optus rolled out, amongst other things, hybrid fiber coax networks that were intended for use for broadcasting pay TV service or subscription television service to the public, but also had the ability to carry high-speed data and telephony service as well. And then what happened over the period from 1997 to the present was that what we observed is that instead of that providing the foundation for, even just in the metropolitan areas, the main cities, full facilities-based competition, instead what we saw was the growth of competition which became ever more reliant on Telstra's network. So that instead of having competing networks really going head to head, as we see in many countries in the world, instead what we got was increasing resale-based competition. And so the question that raises is, well, why did that happen? And of course, as economists and social scientists, the approach we take to these issues is to look at data, i.e. information, we can find it, and try to analyse on the basis of that information what factors might be at work. And unusually, because most of the time we're very frustrated in our ability to do that, in telecommunications we have a terrific natural experiment, as we call them. And that natural experiment is the fact that many countries around the world liberalized at just about the same time. And those countries each adopted slightly different policies. And each of those countries then had slightly different outcomes. Now, of course, you have the eternal problem when you do studies of that kind, that is often summarized by saying that there are too many variables and too few observations, because the number of countries is limited, but there are many, many factors that will go into influencing outcomes. But luckily, in this case, we happen to have a fairly large number of observations, because we have a fair number of countries. The timing is pretty similar, there are some differences. And in some countries, we also have observations within the country. For instance, in the United States, a very large component of the regulatory arrangements is devolved to the states. And so you have, as it were, different observations for each of the jurisdictions. Okay? And so you can use that material to develop models and test models, and look at, well, what's been significant and what hasn't. And there's been a very large body of work done in recent years that takes the benefit of that sampling frame, or that set of data, and says, well, what does that tell us is significant in influencing whether or not facilities-based competition develops, or what forms of competition develop? Do you get full head-on competition between networks, or do you just get resale competition, or do you get no competition at all? Now, one of the things you can readily observe when you look at that data is that there are many cities that are far smaller and in some cases sparser than our main metropolitan areas, would seem to sustain quite efficiently two, three, or four competing networks. It's obviously a different issue when you go to, you know, Megathara relative to Sydney, or when you go to the outlying parts of Sweden or Finland relative to their metropolitan areas. But nonetheless, you observe that our scale, particularly in our metropolitan areas, which account for, of course, a very large share of our population, our scale doesn't seem to be the differentiating factor. And instead, what emerges as the clearly most significant differentiating factor is how access charges are set. And there's now a number of studies, being published in highly reputable journals with reputable data set, so that other people have used the same data and tested those observations. And the one conclusion that consistently emerges is this, and it's an obvious one when you think about it. It's so strikingly consistent with everything we teach in elementary economics. And that conclusion is this, that if you make it cheap to use the price, to use the existing network, relative to building and using competing networks, well, what happens? Well, exactly what you would expect happens, which is that people respond to the price signal. And they respond to the price signal by shifting use from other networks onto the networks whose prices are set at relatively low levels. Now, Australia is extreme in that respect, because in most other countries, when you look at those jurisdictions where access prices have been set relatively low, and there are few which have had such steep reductions in access charges as Australia has had, our reductions are much greater than those in the US or the EU, even though they start from an optimized base, so even if you start from 2001-2002. Okay? But what we see that makes our case exceptional is that in most countries, facilities-based competition, when you have very low access charges, simply doesn't arise. In Australia, what happened is that we have an existing network, the Optus network, that ran past millions of households. And so all you were looking at there were the operating and maintenance costs of that network, because its costs were sunk, its capital costs were sunk. And yet, Optus made very little use of that network, and when DSL took off, shifted from expanding that network to relying ever more heavily on telcos. Now, that, as I said, is nothing more than elementary economics, which teaches you that if you reduce the price of a good, what happens is that more of it is consumed, and less is consumed of its substitutes. What was more consumed of? Well, you reduced the price, the relative price of using Telstra's network, so more of that network was used, less was used of the competing alternative. Now, you can also use the data, and Bob Crandall has done this, Ellie Noam has done this recently, and Paul McElroy from Yale has done that, so it's really first-rate economists. To look at, does vertical or horizontal integration by the incumbents matter much? And does structural separation help or hinder? Which then brings me to the alleged prescription. And what you see when you look again at the data is this, that first is simply no evidence that countries which have structurally separated their telcos do better in any dimension of performance relative to those that haven't. And second, and related to that. Structural separation appears to be highly costly, and so when you take the costs into account, the benefits in net terms come out strongly negative. And there's a very nice piece by Ellie Noem, who's the head of the Telecommunications Institute at Columbia and professor of economics and finance at Columbia. There's a very nice piece by Ellie Noem in the Financial Times a few weeks ago, where Ellie Noem said, and Ellie's been an advocate of structural separation ever since I met him, which was in 1978. So when most of the people in this room were in primary school, where Ellie said, I was an advocate of structural separation for 20 years. I've now looked at the data, and I've changed my mind. And I've looked at my data, and I've come to the conclusion, and this is the heading of the more scholarly article he's written on this, that the Bell system died in vain. It died in vain because it was dismembered for on the sake of a theory of which he was a proponent. And yet, when he set out to systematically compare the U.S. with what had happened in Canada, where they didn't pursue the same policy, he found the Canadian outcomes were consistently better than outcomes in the United States. And Paul McAvoy comes to the conclusion that, in fact, structural separation in the U.S. increased price-cost margins and hence harmed consumers, while Crandall, who looks at a very wide data set, Paul McAvoy is a professor of economics at Yale, Bob Crandall is senior fellow in economics at Brookings. Bob Crandall has looked at a very wide sample, and he comes to the conclusion that there is only one country out of this sample where separation yielded any benefits, and in that country, the benefits could have been obtained at lower cost by reforming the access regime. And so he comes to the conclusion that there was just no net benefit there. And that's, as I say, again, not terribly puzzling, either from the economics point of view or from the practical point of view. From the economics point of view, because we know there are efficiencies associated with vertical integration. And so even though it's true, vertically integrated firms may have incentives to act in anti-competitive ways, but they also secure big efficiencies. And so the question is, how do you deal with the risk of anti-competitive conduct at least cost? Well, unscrambling beyond it is usually not the most efficient way of doing it. So it's not surprising from the economics point of view, nor is it at all surprising from a practical point of view, because all you have to do is, for instance, compare two of the most highly vertically integrated and horizontally integrated telcos in the world, far more integrated than Telstra, the Norwegian and the Danish. Compare them with what's happening in the UK, New Zealand, and the US. And how have they been so successful? Well, one way they've been so successful is because they operated across multiple platforms and had coordinated the upgrading of those platforms. So, for example, both the Norwegians and the Danes have been quite aggressive in offering services across both a copper platform, or a copper platform, a fiber platform, and a hybrid fiber coax platform. And that's given them great, what we call economies of scope in economics, and allowed them to be very efficient. But all of that said, Paul and I, it reminds me of the Spanish Civil War. And it ended in 1939, and people kept fighting it until early 1980s. So they would get together and say, well, you know, we did this and we did that and so on and so forth. And Tom Miller has that marvelous song where he says, you know, they may have won all the battles, but we had all the good songs. And so we're really fighting all of this. And of course, what's happened is the government has basically said, well, you know, stick to your playpen, we're changing the rules. We're changing the game. And really, the question that raises is, well, what does that mean in terms of going forward? And I think that raises some really big questions and challenges. I think it raises questions and challenges because, my view, it's a very risky venture, it's a very costly venture. You look around the world, you won't find, there are two other countries that have schemes of this level of ambition. Greece, but it hasn't yet been approved by the EU and is conditional on EU funding. And Finland, but Finland's objective is 2020. And their subsidies are much more targeted and limited than what is proposed here. So there are big questions about value for money. But even if you take all of that as given and say, well, what about policy? There's still some really big policy issues that need to be addressed. And I'll just list them and then I'll shut up because I'm at the limits of my allotted time and I want to be respectful of that. A first question is, how can we, if we go ahead with this proposal, how can we deal with a situation, or best deal with a situation, where the government will be back as both regulator and investor? And that, it seems to me, really requires us to look very carefully at the transparency of our regulatory arrangements and the risks that will create. A second and related question is, how do we, in this new environment associated with an NBN, preserve the benefits of competition? And my own view, which is very consistent with what you see coming out of a lot of the best cost modeling that is being done, is that there's ample scope for competing supply, especially when you consider that we have some assets in place that can and should compete with the NBN, including the copper networks, the hybrid fiber coax networks, and we will have competition coming from wires. And so it's important to preserve competitive tensions in the new environment. And that requires great attention to competitive neutrality to ensure that you don't distort the playing field by subsidizing one technology at the expense of others that may be more efficient. It also requires close attention to the structure of any joint venture because we know that these kinds of joint venture arrangements where all the market participants get together to own an upstream asset and then compete downstream can be an easy vehicle for anti-competitive practices, including the risk of pollution. So you have to be very mindful of that. And then the big set of issues is, do we want to have a wholesale-only model or not? And my own view on that is that, look, there's lots of pluses and minuses in this, but if you look at experience internationally, there are very few instances where the wholesale-only model has worked. And there are some very good reasons for that. And so you need to be very cautious about recommending a wholesale-only model. And most of the instances where wholesale-only has worked, it's been very, very heavily subsidized on an ongoing basis. Okay? And then the fourth and final question is, how do you deal with the fact that there are going to be pressures to have very significant cross-subsidization in prices within this new network? And we've spent many years trying to remove pricing distortions from the existing network. It would be a shame if we just set the clock back and started where we had been in the 70s all over again. I'll stop there and my apologies for interrupting. I should have, but I'm very happy to send you the paper.
Thank you very much, Henry, and thank you for saving me from having to bill you with a ding, 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 Mr. Ergus. Your call time is up. Would you like to extend? Save. I'm going to ask both Paul and Henry to join me out the front, and we have time for some questions. Look, it's particularly interesting. We have two experts in telecommunications. We have two experts in competition policy in telecommunications, and they're competing with their views on competition policy. They're going to volunteer to answer your questions, but given Henry's approach to competition in telecommunication, which is new entrants is good, perhaps there might be some new entrants from the audience to answer some of the questions as well, but Paul might have a bit of a different view on the prospect of that. So I'm sure we have some questions. If you wouldn't mind hopping to your feet and saying who you are, and we'll go accordingly. Hands first.
Thanks, Matt.
Mr. Ramsey.
Yeah, Rowan Ramsey, member for Grey in South Australia. I'm interested from either of you, given the framework as we understand it at the moment, as much as we understand about the government's broadband platform, what are the prospects of actually enticing private industry to invest the $22 billion in that, given that they weren't prepared to find the $5 billion under the previous arrangements? I mean, what is different in this new plan in the pricing structure, or don't we know enough that it'll actually entice that extra $17 billion out of the players?
Henry.
Well, I think that's a fair question, and clearly that will be at the centre of at least the financial aspects of the implementation study the government's currently undertaking. If you look internationally, I mean, broadly what's happening at the moment, I mean, it's a very mixed picture as usual, but broadly what's happening at the moment is that for a range of reasons there's a slowdown in deployment of fibre to the premises networks. That doesn't mean that growth has stopped, because it hasn't, but it is a fairly pronounced slowing, and that really reflects two sets of factors. The first set of factors is that we've had an overall slowdown in economic activity and some uncertainty about the long-term cost of capital going forward, so there's some financial uncertainties there. And then a second set of factors is questions about whether there will be the take-up that really is required to make these networks viable, and that is a very controversial and uncertain issue at the moment. And until people come to a clearer view on that, I think there will be a fairly natural reluctance to commit large sums of money to build an entirely new network. I have a slide, I won't show it now, but I have a nice slide that the Finns have produced. And it's a slide that looks at how many people in Finland have available to them 100 megabit second connections. Okay. And it turns out that it's about 38-40% of the population have 100 megabits available to them. Okay. And what proportion take speeds greater than 10 megabits? It turns out that it's about 1.5% of the population.
Thank you, Henry. Paul.
So I think if you were looking at that question as a private sector investor, and I suspect this will be the mindset the implementation statement will bring to it, at least to start with, the first question you'd say is, okay, given the amount of capital we're investing, what kind of take-up do we expect to get? That is to say, how many people will buy the service, and how many people will spend what they spend today, which is typically an average customer spends about $6 a month on voice and about $3 a month on broadband, so roughly $100 a month. Do we expect that people will pay more than that? And then, what do we think they'll be paying for? So how confident are we? And then we work that through to a set of revenues, and you say, okay, well, are we going to get payback? And I think the first level at which you ask that question is, You do it the same way the Telstra would do it. So assume that we own the monopoly access network, how many people would we get to take up the higher speed services? Now you need to overlay on that what you think is going to happen in the broadband and telecoms market, because people over time are going to spend less on voice telephony. The premium that is charged for voice telephony today is going to get competed away. And therefore, for the business strategy to succeed, what the operators will be seeking to do is to persuade people to spend more each month on broadband. But of course, you have to demonstrate value, that there's something there that people want to take. But anyway, so the first question would be, if you were Telstra analysing the question as the owner of a monopoly network, do you think people will buy more services sufficient to generate a return on capital? And then the second question that needs to be asked is, will it be a monopoly network, or will in fact there will be one access network owned by Telstra, its current network, and then another access network owned by NBN Co. And if you believe that's the scenario, then you also need to say, okay, well, how much of the current market do we expect that NBN Co will be able to attract across to its network? So that's, I think, the sort of framework that the implementation study will need to work through to answer that question, which is, what kind of payback do you think is available, and therefore will private sector investors find it attractive?
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Anyone else to place a call or a question?
Greg Page, Senator Williams. The proposal is to cover 90% of Australia, which means, I think they're saying tens of less than 1,000 won't be covered. Does that mean that the network is going to be deficient? Particularly out in the bush where they're now screaming, saying you've forgotten all about us. Do they have the capability to make 100% for the fast speed broadband, or is it just all political?
Well, I referred earlier to the Finnish scheme, which it should be said is a subject of great controversy in Finland at the moment, but the Finnish scheme extends to 100% of the Finnish population. However, they then immediately start caveating it. And the way they've caveated it is that there will be fiber within a given number of kilometres of every premise in Finland. And at the moment, that number is fixed at 2 kilometres, but when I was in Europe a couple of weeks ago, they said they were thinking of increasing it to 20 kilometres. They haven't quite decided. And that is an enormously expensive scheme. It's just enormously expensive, and that's why they're thinking of waiting until 2020, and that's why the Finnish Treasury came up with this chart that I have, which says, look, even in Helsinki, we find it difficult to convince people to pay. Well, being asked to pay for 100 megabits, I think it's 2.5 times as much as they pay for 1 megabit second connection. Okay? And yet, they're not taking 100 megabits. They just don't see value in it at the moment. Okay? And so to provide them with a huge pipe, you look at that in social cost-benefit terms, and you say, well, how can that possibly be justified? And both the Finnish Treasury and the Finnish Central Bank have said, where's the cost-benefit study? And that's a fair question. So sure, you can do it to anywhere you want. The question is, do the benefits exceed the cost? And it may well be that there are more efficient ways of providing people, wherever they may live in Australia, with the sort of connectivity they need at much, much lower cost than actually streaming or providing a fibre connection to absolutely every home.
Thank you, Henry. Paul, do you want to proffer a view?
We've got
one more call waiting.
I just had a couple of quick comments to that. When I first started working for Richard Alston, who was then Communications Minister, and James Shaw, who worked with him at the same time, I'm sure vindicate this recollection, a very large amount of political energy was devoted to the question of how do you, to the maximum extent possible, deliver services in rural and regional Australia, which are as close as possible to those in metro Australia. But that objective is bedeviled by the fundamental economics that Henry has mentioned, namely it is vastly more expensive to serve people in the last decile from 90 to 100% than in the cities. I mean, a good indicator is what Telstra, where Telstra drew the line in its 2005 proposal, where they said we'll spend $4 billion to deliver a fiber node network to 4 million premises in the five capital cities. And if you say that's almost 50%, then each succeeding decile beyond that gets more and more and more expensive. And then the other point is that using a fixed line technology means you are incurring a very high fixed capital cost to build out, you know, to physically trench a fibre when it might only have a very small number of premises connected to it in the same space that in the city would have thousands. So the economics are very, very challenging, and yet the politics are inevitably that wherever you draw a dividing line, you immediately invite everybody on the other side of the dividing line to say, hey, where's mine? I'm not sure there's an easy solution, but other than to say the right choice of technology is critical, so that you're using the most cost-effective, and conventionally it's thought that wireless and satellite are the best suited to the lower population density areas. And then the other point to make is, I'm sure that what the implementation study will look at is, are there ways that you can meet the headline commitment but reduce the cost? For example, does the commitment mean that every home is passed by a fibre and then has a subscriber drop connecting from the fibre to the home? Or do you not put the drop in until the customer says, I want the service, and do you also charge them, say, a $400 connection fee? Because if that's the case, then you will probably reduce your upfront capital cost by quite a bit.
Thank you, Paul. Now I'm going to take the call waiting on the basis that each of our experts restricts their answer, do the best you can, to a minute, which is after all what our ministers now have to do in the Senate, answering their supplementary and third question.
It's simpler because it's only a question to one of you.
Ian Holland, one of them,
Ian Holland from the Senate Environment, Communications and the Arts Committee. The question is to Paul. You talked about structural separation as an option. The strength of Henry's presentation, I thought, was the use of the referee-published empirical international studies on this, and they went directly to that question. What is your response to those studies?
The first point I'd make is that Henry's... What Henry focused on was criticisms of a particular solution, but I think the question before that is, what is the answer to the fundamental problem in Australian telecommunications that we have not really got a competitive market structure and fixed line? And it was unclear to me from what Henry said whether he was supportive of unbundling, which has been an important intermediate step in markets like the UK and France, where you have seen broadband penetration levels go up, significant degrees of innovation, and so on. So in substance, I think what I'd say is, look, I'm not sure I agree with Henry's clever rhetorical technique, which is to say, let's not worry about fighting those battles of the past because the government has totally changed the rules of the game. What I'd say is, I think for at least a decade, we've still got a really serious issue to deal with, which is, how do you address the vertical integration of Telstra in its present form? And in my view, you need structural separation to get the incentives right. I speak from my experience having been responsible for several years for procurement from Telstra, from its largest customer, and their lack of interest in selling services was a major impediment to the vigour of competition at the retail level.
Thank you, Paul. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking our guests and experts. Thank you. Oh, and thank you to the Parliamentary Library and Rock Band. Thank you.
Network for reactive reach.
Oh, very good. They did not. Fair.